thank you to George Perry and the nominee committee for inviting me down. Had to show a little bit of snow in the picture, I guess. So also, this is a good place to start, too, because the topic is managing bull development. And it takes you lose a lot of bulls on the way to getting a bull to Aries overwintering 3-4 years in a row without running into troubles. But it's a big subject, and so I won't be able to really cover much of it. So another way of looking at this is rearing bulls for fertility, is what I'm talking about. And as I mentioned, you could do a lot on selection. You could talk a lot about colostrum and vaccination and so on. But I think what I mainly am going to have time for is to talk about nutrition. So if you look into the literature on the effect of nutrition on development of bulls reproductively, there's lots, many, 30, 50 papers if you really look for them, on the effect of post-weaning nutrition. And that kind of makes sense because once the calves are home from pasture and you have a captive audience to work with, then it's easy to do some work with them research-wise. So mostly what these papers would be assuming is a normal calfhood nutrition, although that's not normally talked about. And the endpoints of research, if they're talking about reproduction, would be testis size, age at puberty, and semen quality. And these are all very interrelated things. So that's what I'll be talking about today. So I want to give you a kind of a feel for what you would be reading if you were to do a literature search on effective nutrition on post-weaning period. So I'm going to give you about 4 slides that sort of summarizes what I've found. So I'll give you, the first one comes from Canada, from Alberta. And in that case, bulls aged 6 months to 11 and a half months were fed for about 160 days. There were 2 77-day feeding periods, and sometimes they would switch their nutritional intake. So they could get either a high level of intake or low, and they have them pointed out here, but this is roughly about a good 135% above what's recommended. And this one here would be around 85% of what's recommended. So they would they'd split these up into 277-day feeding periods. This group would have gotten the high nutrition both in both periods. This one high and low, then low and high, and then the last guys, they got only 85% recommended throughout. And what we can see is that there's quite a difference in scroll circumference. 3 centimeters between the ones that got very high levels of nutrition through that five and a half month period and the low. But here's another paper, Seidel, 1980, Effective Energy Intake on Testicular Development. And again, in that same period, 7 months to 11 months of age. And a little bit more energy in the low energy side, about 95% of recommended levels, but otherwise very high recommended level of intake in the high group. The higher energy diet did result in a larger scroll circumference, so the two papers are in agreement on that, but there was no difference in testis weight. Not statistically speaking, anyway. They did look like they were a little bit heavier on the high energy intake side, but a lot heavier scrotal weight. So both the fat, he lopped the scrotum off at the level of the belly, so there's a lot of fat inside the scrotum and in the scrotal wall, which accounted for at least some of the increased scrotal circumference for bulls fed high energy rations in the post-weaning period. So here's another paper, Pruitt and Cora, 1986, feeding Simmental and Hereford bulls, again the same period of time, 7 months to 14 months of age, balanced rations except for level of energy. And I'm just going to be looking at scrotal circumference. They looked at other things like body weight, serving capacity, and semen quality or so on. But what I'm showing here is the scrotal circumference. So here's the Simmentals. Here's the Herefords. day of trial, day zero. And one of the things that I noticed was that on this, in the Simmental group, the group receiving the high energy intake started out with about a 0.8 centimeter, almost a centimeter bigger, the ones than in the medium group, and yet they ended up with only 3 centimeters difference, or 0.3 centimeters difference on average. And you look on the Hereford side, they were a little more close together maybe here and what they started with, but certainly no difference in scroll circumference, whether they were fed the low energy, the medium energy, or the high energy intakes. So it's quite interesting that we do see 3 different papers here with not really consistent results. The first one would have said you'll get much bigger scroll circumference. Next one said that might be fat. And this one says we saw no difference. The higher levels of energy in a post-weaning period resulted in little or no increase in scroll circumference and did not hasten puberty. Well, if you aren't watching carefully what you're reading, you can sometimes get mixed up as well. Here's a study of, he's from the eastern U.S., effect of energy intake on scroll circumference, but the feeding period here is different. They're almost a year of age when they started feeding. And in this case, the high gain group, gaining 1.7 kilograms per day, that's, if you don't like kilograms, that's about 3.75 pounds a day, versus the low gain group that were gaining under 2 pounds a day. But we see that, I'm messing this advancing thing all the time. See a difference in scroll circumference, 34 versus 31.7, a little over 2 centimeters difference. And unlike the other experiments, a difference in testis weight if they're on low gain. But I think the difference here is that they were feeding bulls that are almost mature, 12 months of age, well, getting close anyway. And what you might be seeing here really is that the bulls on the low energy side were getting environmental cues not to produce sperm. That's a simple way of putting it. But environmental cues are provided by these metabolic hormones like leptin, insulin-like growth factor, growth hormone, insulin, which actually tell the hypothalamus how much FSH and LH to secrete. And in that sense, you might say their Sertoli cells were running at half empty because of the environmental cues saying that the world is tough out there, don't worry about reproduction, worry about survival. So summarizing those papers, and it's kind of what I find in all of the papers that I looked at, was that you might get an increase in scroll circumference, you might not, if you feed excessive energy intakes. And part of that could be, if there is an increase, that part of it at least could be fat in the scrotum. Is there an effect on testis development? You might have concluded that there was if you looked at that last paper by Ohl, and it's still possibly a little bit of a question mark. And it's not really clear yet to me whether age at puberty was advanced from these studies. So most of my life I've been asking this question of myself. Why is there this sort of disagreement in this post-weaning nutrition? How much does it matter whether we went with, which we never will, let's just feed our bulls hay and grow them out that way for sale and forget about fattening them up like feedlot steers? That'll never happen. But what would really, how would that really affect testis development? Now I want to talk about calfhood nutrition. The difference here is that if you try to find a paper on calfhood nutrition, there's almost nothing available. Oops. So before I go to the next slide, here's actually a 1990s, early 90s picture on my brother's farm. And you can see they have the traditional, this is actually a commercial beef herd, not a purebred herd, but it looks like a purebred Simmental herd. You can tell by the canola fields in the background what time of year this is. This is about July 10th or 15th. And these calves were born in March and April. Tremendous calves. Rotational grazing, knee-deep in grass, and look at the udders on the mother, and you can see why we've got some very growthy calves there. In contrast, maybe a different year, a different place or something, overgrazed pasture, probably some drought effect, Charolais mothers, most likely, I don't have much trouble convincing you that there could be a difference here between those two scenarios on calfhood nutrition. This is what I could find in the literature on calfhood nutrition. One abstract on Holsteins. One abstract. They fed calves from 1 to 80 weeks of age, collected semen every 14 days once they were getting towards pubertal. Very, very big difference in the percent of recommended intake. 60 to 70% in this group, 140 to 160% in the other group. A tremendous effect on age at puberty. 57 weeks versus 43 is a difference of 14 weeks, 3.5 months difference in age at onset of puberty. When you go farther down the road, it doesn't matter that much. As you can see, they were producing good semen quality and good pregnancy rates in all cases later on. But there was a huge effect, and I'm suggesting that it was because of nourishment during calfhood, not so much the post-weaning period. Well, there is other evidence for a calfhood weaning effect. For example, Lundstra, this is Clay Center, Nebraska data, indicates that scroll circumference was 1.5 centimeters smaller in yearling bulls that have first parity dams. And in Saskatoon, scroll circumference was 2.4 centimeters small in 11-month-old bulls with first parity dams. So why is that? Well, maybe the heifer mothers give less milk. It's one possibility. Maybe there's an in utero effect, because calves raised by heifers are going to have smaller weaning weights. There'll be smaller animals in the fall. Maybe that's the effect. So good questions there. Well, I have a brother-in-law who's a pastor, and he always says you should tell people what you're going to talk about, then talk about it, and then tell them what you told them. So I'm going to tell you what I'm going to talk about. The main basis of the calfhood effect on age at onset of puberty is gonadotrophin secretion from 8 to 16 weeks of age. The first clue I had of this was from Evan's work in 1994, when he just looked in retrospect at a group of bulls he'd been doing hormone studies on, and he saw that the ones that had early puberty, and also, by the way, they had the larger scroll circumference, the larger testes, had quite a large difference in the profile of LH secretion centered right around here at 12 weeks of age, between 8 and 16 weeks. So the early puberty ones, much more LH. So a lot of little experiments were done at that time, and one of them was to look at, maybe if that's the case, what if we augmented LH just before the early gonadotrophin rise? So treating with LH-releasing hormone every 2 hours for 14 days from 4 to 6 weeks of age, and then a lot of blood sampling every 15 minutes for 10 hours, 4, 6, 12, 18, 24 weeks of age. What did we see? Well, the LHRH worked. We got an increase in LH pulse frequency, increased amount of mean LH and testosterone, and at a year of age, testis size was 2 centimeters bigger in the bulls that had the augmented LH in that early calfhood period. And along with it, because of the larger testes, earlier puberty, more increase in sperm concentration. If you did histology, you'd see that spermatogenesis was more advanced. And I'd like to throw this little plug in, because I'm going to talk a bit more about it later. More Sertoli cells per cross-section of tubule. Well, if you can do that by augmenting, what would happen if you inhibited that LH rise? And you can do that as well. And that was done by treating with leuprolide, at 4, 6, and 10, 6 and 10 and 14 weeks of age. Again, a lot of blood sampling. And sure enough, suppressed LH and also FSH pulse frequency and amplitude, suppressed FSH and testosterone at 14, 16, 18 weeks, smaller scroll circumference, and also it affected spermatogenesis. So you can actually augment it and decrease it, and it, all of it confirms that there's a big, strong cathode effect of that early gonadotropin rise on testis size and age of puberty. Later on, we also did some work with FSH. And so FSH a little bit harder to work with. It's harder to get significant data with FSH. So there wasn't a lot of FSH stuff published until more recent years. And so this was one of our guys, Bagu, showing mean FSH in blood samples collected every 15 minutes. This is normal untreated calves, just a bunch of calves. And you can see that right around 12 weeks, we have a significant difference in the levels of FSH. So FSH is going up at the same time there as LH. And he tried some things as well in which were treated with FSH, 4 milligrams of FSH, and he had two other groups, one receiving LH and another saline, every second day from 4 to 8 weeks of age. And if we looked at scrotal circumference, you can see that in that last 38 to 42 weeks here, the levels of the scrotal circumference is higher for the ones treated with FSH than in the saline-treated group. And if you look at the difference, just look at the size of this spread here and compare it to your axis, and you can see that we had a difference of 3 to 4 centimeters in the ones that were treated with FSH. So both FSH and LH are involved in this rise, the gonadotropin rise, and in pubertal development. He also looked at mean Sertoli and germ cell counts in calves treated every second day with that FSH, LH, saline, just like I showed you before in the graph. And we can see that the number of Sertoli cells for the FSH group was significantly higher than in the other groups. And also spermatogenesis was more advanced. So that's kind of an important finding as well, because FSH has long been considered to be the main driver of Sertoli cell proliferation in prepubertal animals. And in laboratory animals, the final lifetime number of Sertoli cells is achieved during pubertal development. So before they even ever get mature, no more Sertoli cells. The final number is determined. Interestingly, the same thing looks to be true for the bull. Get to that in the next slide after this one. This is a very simple slide, again, showing Sertoli cell development and just any old group of bull calves you might look at. So Bagu was looking at these numbers of Sertoli cells from 5 to 56 weeks of age. Now I want to explain this graph a bit. So you see the solid circles here, and these are actually representing the indifferent supporting cells, sort of the Sertoli precursor cells. And of course, if these are precursor cells turn into Sertoli cells, then as those cells decline, the Sertoli cells are going to increase, because one is just simply turning into the other one. Here we can see two important points, right here and here. So at about 24 weeks of age, the number of Sertoli cells was the same, X and Y, as out at 56 weeks of age, suggesting that calves also have reached their final Sertoli cell number before weaning, by 24, 25 weeks of age. Summarizing these things then, the magnitude of the early gonadotropin rise is a critical factor in pubertal development. Sertoli cell numbers in bulls I've got a data stated pretty positively there, but Sertoli cells in bulls probably at least reach a final maximum lifetime number at 20 to 25 weeks of age. When you think about Sertoli cells, they're the supporters of the germinal cells. The number of germinal cells a Sertoli cell can support is finite. It can only support so many. But they can also run at half empty. And if they're running at half empty, a bull's testes will actually be smaller. So, for example, mature bulls, in the springtime, after a good winter feeding period, good grass, you usually measure a couple centimeters bigger than if you measure them in September after they've done breeding and they're on maybe declining quality of pasture. Scrotal circumference declines a couple centimeters because Sertoli cells are running at half empty. The other important thing that this likely means is that the final testis size is determined before weaning. Interesting. So it doesn't matter then how you feed them post-weaning, does it? Unless it's really severely bad or something. It doesn't matter if you feed them what's recommended or 30% in excess of what's recommended. The same potential testis size is there. And I mentioned, as I have in this slide, Sertoli cells can run at half empty, and that's run influenced by environmental signals. The insulin, like growth factors, leptin, and so on, that affect the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus, in turn, is secreting the gonadotropin-releasing hormones, LH and FSH. And FSH, in particular, we know, is a recruiter of B spermatogonia. So if FSH is suppressed, you're going to have suppressed spermatogenesis, fewer cells per Sertoli cell. Well, still less question about does calf food nutrition have an effect on onset of puberty and maturity? We know that the gonadotropin surge is important. Perhaps it's affected by nutrition. Perhaps it's still a big effect of in utero effect in a heifer. So we did this experiment in 2006. Leo Brito, guy from Brazil, tremendous fellows working for ABS Global now. Nutrition, metabolic hormones, and sexual development in bulls. It's a 600-some page thesis, but I'm going to boil it down to a few slides. So trying to better speed up a bit here, we had Angus and Angus Charlet. Calves from first parity dams are weaned at 8 weeks. And we looked at them. We called calfhood the period of 10 to 26 weeks, and post-weaning would be 27 weeks and on. A lot of blood sampling from 10 to 14 weeks, 10 to 20 weeks of age, and again at 44 and 48 weeks. Every 15 minutes for 10 hours, then we gave them GnRH challenges and still bred yet another 90 minutes. Here's the four experiments. Experiment one, just like most people have done, we just looked at the post-weaning period. Let's do that again, giving them low, medium, or high energy intakes. Experiment two, let's do it throughout, from calfhood through 17 months of age. And then in the third experiment, let's restrict them in calfhood, and in the fourth experiment, let's augment nutrition in calfhood. Otherwise, they're hopefully very similar groups in how they're treated. So results of experiment one is a post-weaning period group, low energy intake versus high. There's no difference in age at puberty. They're identical. There's one calf in here that kind of skewed this data a bit in the medium group. Paired testis weight, actually no difference again in the low energy intake group versus the high. And I didn't mention what high and medium and low was, but high was about 125%, low was about 90% of recommended intake. Experiment two, this is the feeding levels throughout from weaning on in this case it was from 8 weeks on throughout 17 months of age. Low energy intakes, puberty, 327, significantly longer to puberty than the ones getting the high energy intakes. So here's your calf foot effect. If they get treated rather poorly in calf foot, it'll take them longer to get to puberty, just like we saw in that Holstein data of Bratton from 1956. What if we were to restrict nutrition in calf foot, but then give them good nutrition in the post-weaning period? So this group had good nutrition in calf foot, good nutrition post-weaning, poor nutrition in calf foot, then excessive or just recommended in the post-weaning period. And this shows days to puberty. The ones that were on the low or the poor nutrition in calf foot had a good month longer to puberty. And you couldn't fix anything by giving excessive energy in the post-weaning period. And it also similarly affected testis weight, so that the ones that had the low energy intakes in calfhood had smaller testes than the ones that had just the recommended amount in calfhood. In experiment four, we augmented. We gave them actually extra or excessive nutrition, you might say, in calfhood, and it resulted in hastened puberty and increased testis size. So we could conclude then that nutrition does regulate GnRH secretion during the early gonadotrophin rise. Delayed puberty in bulls raised by first parity dams probably does have a nutritional component. Maybe still there is still an in utero effect, but we know that there's a nutritional effect. Management strategies to optimize reproductive function should therefore be focused on calfhood, not the post-weaning period. And this last line we actually can't substantiate with our data, but we're suggesting that the average daily gain in the pre-weaning period should be at least 1.2 kilos per day, which isn't really asking very much, because just good nursing mothers, they'll gain what much more than that. And I think because I've used up my half hour, I'll stop here.